Review. During the first session of the 13th Alaska Legislature, Alaskan Legislative Review brought to our listeners informed discussion of important public issues and problems featuring the faculty and staff of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Now that the legislature has adjourned, we are turning our attention to discussion of how the legislature addressed some of those problems by talking with the legislators themselves. Our guest today is State Senator Pappy Moss. Senator Moss was first elected to the Alaska House of Representatives in 1978, running as a Democrat from Delta Junction. He was re-elected to the House in 1980, and in 1982 he ran for the Senate in the newly apportioned Senate District J. Upon winning his race, Senator Moss joined a majority in the Senate under the leadership of Senator Jay Kurtula. Senator Moss is chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, the Special Agricultural Committee, and holds a seat on the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. Senator Moss has a strong interest in agriculture, a subject of considerable importance to his constituents in his district. Aside from being a legislator, Pappy has worked as a farmer, an aircraft engine mechanic, a bush pilot, and has lived in Alaska since 1963. Pappy, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you. I guess I'd like to start out by asking you, why did you choose to leave the House and run for the Senate?
Well, for one thing, I was doing most of my work for my constituency over in the Senate anyway. I found that the last 2 years, for example, that I was in the House, I was in the minority, but I still had some pretty good friends over in the Senate side, so anything we needed in my district, I didn't go to the House for it, I went over to the Senate side. I found that the Senate tends to work in a more calm manner. You don't seem to have to raise so much cane out there on the floor and do all your committee work on the floor, but you try to do it in the proper places in committee and so forth. I think that the Senate side, we have our differences of opinion on occasion, but I think that the Senate works more calmly and without getting a lot of rhetoric all tangled up to where we don't get anything done.
So you found going over to the Senate to be to your advantage as far as your constituents go?
Yes, I think it's definitely been to our advantage. I know that District J this time, which incidentally includes half of the geography of the North Star Borough, is doing very well. Young Mike Miller, that's a freshman in the House side there, and I have had one whale of a team. We work very closely together, and it's been a privilege working with him. So I have a real vested interest, as I always have had, in the Fairbanks area in the interior.
Well, good. Let's discuss some specific issues that the legislature addressed this session. One problem the legislature faced was declining state revenues due to falling oil prices on the world market. And at one point, the Senate proposed using permanent fund monies for capital projects. Did you support that proposal?
Now, let's just be careful when you say permanent fund monies. Permanent fund itself is locked up and it's set to make interest. Now, when we start talking about the permanent fund dividends or the permanent fund income, there's where we're beginning to look at the things that the Senate was trying to do. We were not touching the permanent fund itself. In fact, of the business, I might point out that it was the legislature that added $2.7 billion to the permanent fund over the past 3 or 4 years. That was not called for by the Constitution. In fact, of the matter, if the legislature had not added that $2.7 billion, we wouldn't be getting the permanent fund dividends that we are from the interest created by the fund. And part of the reason we were looking at the interest of the unallocated interest is what it actually is. We looked at it because we had a very big concern, and we still have a big concern. Our pioneer homes may be affected, our pioneer bonuses may be affected, and a number of the other things that we needed to continue on with. Unfortunately, our senior citizens may have just received their last check for a while under the bonus program. What we attempted to do was to take part of the interest money, and I emphasize interest money, from the unallocated interest in the permanent fund income to use for some of these programs.
So by unallocated, you were just looking at money that wasn't already earmarked for dividends or for any other use?
For any specific thing. Now, some people had the idea that we have not inflation-proofed the permanent fund. Now, by George, $2.7 billion, I call that a lot of inflation-proofing.
All right. Many Alaskans have begun to wonder about the budget process that the legislature uses, about how fair is it, how efficient is it in terms of the legislature getting its work done. In your view, what's right and what's wrong about that process?
Well, the present system now, you might as well call it a three-way process. The governor has so many projects that are statewide. The Senate has a portion of it that they want, and the House does. I think that the present setup that we have is not bad at all because of the simple fact that who is really the closest to the people, the governor or the representatives, those 60 representatives that have been elected from each little square or each little precinct. And I can assure you that those senators and those representatives are going to be much more responsive to what those people are asking for out there than the governor will as a whole. The governor, I think, should be the head man. You know, of course, the legislature, the main thing the legislature has is the ability to appropriate funds. The governor does not appropriate money. Fact of the matter is, if you want to look at it, we're doing him a favor by even letting him enter into the process. We do not intend to allow the executive branch to tell the branch of government, which is the House and the Senate, how we are going to appropriate money. The governor can do a certain amount of redlining, and he's going to be doing lots of it here in the next few weeks, I'm sure. But my point is, the governor does not appropriate money. The Senate and House does.
And that was made abundantly clear early in the session when the legislature soundly rejected the governor's request that he receive a lump sum appropriation for each department to allocate as he saw fit.
Yeah, and that brings up another subject that really, really teased me off, because perhaps I should make a comment or two, if I may, about some thoughts that I made in a speech once about what's happening this session. Take a couple of minutes. I might say that I did a speech one time, said some thoughts about this session. This session was unique in that a very high percentage of individual decision makers were relatively new to the system. The obvious problems this lack of expertise created were magnified by the fact that many of the elected individuals, and especially House members, came to the system with a determination that government in general is, at best, a necessary evil which they felt either alienated from or wished no personal part of it. This ironic internal conflict, of course, within many of the newly elected House members, created the atmosphere in which mutual distrust for each other, as members of that evil state government, destroyed the very fibers of essential compromise necessary for the efficient operations of government. Consequently, all attempts to negotiate a solution was a problem. As in all situations where paranoia reigns supreme, this suspicion and distrust clouded the real issues with a deeper and more viable issue of the survival of each individual's personal power. And in turn, the power of the larger group that individual was part of. Many individual elected officials perceive themselves as being the person with the personal mandate to destroy the evil government without a clear understanding, or perhaps without really caring what would be a better system. This knee-jerk reaction to the problem solving in practice seldom solves any problems, and in fact, most likely will simply create new problems while simply delaying the original problem. A case in point is the constitutional questions raised by the House refusal to attend the joint session. With the possible exception of the lawyers who will argue the various positions, there are no winners. There were, however, very clear losers. The legislature lost its credibility, the governor has a cloud over his cabinet, and the voters lost faith in the system. In my view, because of a House run on paranoia, the first session of the 13th legislature had no winners and can point to very few real accomplishments. This is some of the things that I also liken this whole situation to a team. I don't know.
Let me ask you. Mm-hmm. Ideally, a bicameral legislature provides a double check on legislation, with the idea that the more difficult it is to pass a bill, the less likely that bad bills will become law. From your perspective of having served in both the House and the Senate, did you think that system was working this past session in toward that end, toward making it difficult to pass bad legislation?
Well, yes, it worked. It worked more or less as blackmail, in a sense, when you get right down to thinking about it, being realistic. For example, the very fact that they lay a priority system out, the House lays out, we got to have these bills, the Senate lays out, we got to have these. You start horse trading, somebody's going to lose, and generally speaking, it's the people out there. Whenever you start horse trading like that, people perceive that these bills that we were working on were, why in the world did we wait to do it all at the tail end? Nobody knows what's happening. Really, if you stop to think about it, the major part of the work has been done early in the session. So you end up with a knee-jerk reaction that I'm talking about here. If you don't pass my bill today, you sure as the heck ain't going to get yours on our floor tomorrow. This is what's happening. It's a trade-off deal. And you got to have a lot of power on either side, or you got to have some kind of a lever to prize out your own bills over on the other side. You may have a bill that's important to all your constituents. Mm-hmm. But if you can't prove it's important to both the Senate side and the House side or the rest of the legislature, forget it. So it's a power play. And in this case, this year, they tried to do quite a few deals. The main thing, as I said before, had to do with the trade-offs on the governor's ball team, the cabinet members. And that was the dad burnest thing you've ever seen. They were trying to force each other to do certain things.
To little result, end for either side.
And this is what I was talking about, that before this thing is over, we may still be in court. Who knows, really? I think perhaps it was constitutional on the cabinet members' election in the way it was. That's my belief. Of course, they have a lawyer over on the other side that doesn't think so, and some members of the House that doesn't think so. And it brings up a very serious thing about even our budget bills. If we have the people that are handling in these commissioners' offices, these things that we've stipulated has to be done by a division or a department or whatever. When they do that, are they legal? Shall we lose the battle here and have to dig up all these new roads we're hopefully putting in to make it get back right? This mm-hmm. is a problem that we're really faced with.
So there's a cloud hanging over those appointments.
There is a cloud hanging over the appointments, and in turn there is a cloud hanging over every action that was made by the 13th first session.
Okay. This is still related to this subject. The House Majority Coalition has claimed that the Senate has dominated the House in past years, and one reason for all the ill will and dissension between the two bodies was the coalition's refusal to go along with that domination. Do you agree with that argument?
Well, let me tell you what happened. We had a pretty smooth running government until the latter part of the session in 81, when the coalition took over. Just look what's happened since then. We've had a continual problem with every piece of legislation that's come through. We've had nothing but troubles since the coalition has taken over. Now, I'm not trying to get political in this thing. I say coalition, that puts them all in the same basket. The coalition, any political coalition, has to compromise. You may not like the compromise you've got to make, but in order to keep things moving, you have got to compromise to some degree. You cannot sit here and say, I will not do this, period, because they are taking their log rolling me or whatever. Somebody has got to compromise. The Senate this time, I think, in order to get some of the things we've done, we compromised even more than we should have in a way on a lot of things that we compromised on. Well, you got to take care of egos, too. A certain bill comes through with a certain legislator's name on it. They love to see their name on it. Well, I don't give a hoot whose name's on it. If it's good legislation, do your compromise on it and get it out of there. But as far as the, if we continue this next year under the same conditions that we've got, the 13th is going to be one of the most disastrous legislatures that we have ever had. We've got our 25th anniversary coming up next year. I hope that's not the year that we said we had the worst government in the history of the state also.
All right. Let's look at some of the bills of particular importance to the people of the interior. What bills were passed, and you don't have to be totally specific, but what bills were passed and how much money was appropriated for capital projects in Senate District J?
In Senate District J, right now, unless I don't know what's going to be redlined, first I would like to explain something. The majority of the money that we needed in Senate District J had to do with major construction projects such as roads and highways. We got some of the worst highways and roads in the nation. So consequently, quite a bit of money went into the roads and highway system. But between Senate Bill 162 and the 105 and several other bills that passed through, there's probably some $70 million that's gone into District J or would go into it if we don't have any vetoes in it. We've got school projects in there, we've got road projects, and that's where most of your money is. And I might point out that $70 million we're talking about is not all state money. That is money that we have leveraged with a certain amount of general fund money to leverage the federal money.
So you will be getting matching federal funds.
We will be getting matching federal funds, and I don't have in front of me what the match will be. The whole interior, really, we didn't do too bad this year.
Okay.
And
there's a publication called Chaos in the Capitol. It deals with the Alaska budget process, and in that book, you're mentioned in there as saying that you often feel the dilemma a legislator faces is doing right by his constituents and at the same time trying to do right by what he knows to be good government in general. So far as this year's budget went and the kind of things that you did for your district, do you feel like you had to sacrifice a lot in terms of good government to get what you wanted for your constituents, or do you feel you were able to do justice to both?
Well, I think I was able to do justice to both because, and I'll give you an example or two. Seward coal facility, marine highway stuff in the southeast, a number of other things that had to do with things that had no apparent relationship to my district. For example, the coal facility at Seward is out of my district, but we have 850 million tons of coal that's going to go out of our district. It's going to affect the whole interior. That is money that would not show in District J as being done there. It has to be done because that's a statewide thing. And now just recently, for example, we had a military, one of the largest military orders in the history of the state had just come forth on coal at Usabelli. Now we've also begun to work on coal down near Delta out at the Jarvis coal field. We're starting to develop things. Some of the stuff that we've done appears to have no bearing on what is absolutely needed in District J, but it is a future thing that we're looking at. Fact of business, if I might digress just a second. Here a few years ago, I got one of the worst lashings in the public news media and by individual people that any legislator ever had, and it had to do with Chrysler and Iacocca and a $400 million loan. I was real pleased the other night when I found out that I was right all along in that particular thing because Iacocca had just paid off the $400 million. The stock is up. If we had did as I asked us to do at that time, we would have been very well off because the stock has increased many, many fold since that time. That's the kind of things that you look at in the future. That particular money, for example, had no bearing on my particular district at that time, but it's the future that you look into to create these things. I want to see that the railroad gets to the 40-mile country because we're starting to look at all that, but we need rail. We need the rail north to the Ambler Mining District, which is not in my district, but it starts in my district. And we need to get across the Yukon River with that railroad. These are things you look into the future that has apparently no sense for your particular district at the moment. But these are the things we've got to look into in the future.
So you're spending you're talking about being concerned about the long-term view in regard to your constituents as well as the rest of the state, and at the same time trying to provide for those immediate short-term needs that you see, the roads and highways for your district, which we all know are in deplorable condition from the Parks and the Richardson all the way. All right. Going back to how the session went, Governor Sheffield was a new governor. He was not a, I suppose, a politician of any year's experience. He didn't seem to enjoy a very fruitful relationship with the legislature this session. And as you mentioned, on June 7th, a joint session was necessary to try and confirm his appointment. Early on in the session, you were pretty critical in the press about some of the governor's appointees, especially having to do with agriculture. What were your objections to some of those choices?
Well, the biggest problem I had right off the bat, I got my ox gored before I even had a chance to talk to the commissioners. And that ox goring business came out of that Seward grain facility, which we'd worked so hard. We even had the deal set up for the grain deal in North Pole to ship that down to the Matsu Valley. We got a chicken farmer down there that you're buying eggs from up in Fairbanks right now that's using grain from the interior. The critical part about it was we needed that grain facility down there not for export so much as intrastate transport. Kodiak, Bill Burton, and those people out there that have got cattle on Kodiak Island. We've got sheep out at Nikolsky. We ran tests over the past few years and found out that we can feed reindeer barley from Delta and any other place that we can raise it in the state. But part of that deer has to have the feed shipped from a place like the Seward Terminal was. Well, what teed me off with them at the particular time and why I was so mad was they just arrogantly walked in there. They didn't know what the blue blazes they was doing in the first place. If they'd have just talked to us a little bit before they did it, I wouldn't have got so mad. Well, I got mad, and I was right in the fact that they deep-six that thing, and I couldn't figure out why we couldn't stop it. I found out later on by some paperwork that we got that they had settled a court case that said they would never continue on with the Seward Grain Terminal. The problem with that was that they had assured all the farmers and in a teleconference or two that they were going to just put it in mothballs for a while and bring it out when the opportunity existed. But, unbeknownst to anyone, a secret document came out later on that they had settled out of court on the 9th, I believe it was, of January, that they would not continue with the Seward Grain Terminal, even though they had millions of dollars worth of equipment sitting right there to finish it out. And here we are, they're telling us one thing, that they're going to continue this later. But the court agreement they got, they can't touch that thing, and they can't continue to build it according to the agreement which came out of the secret deal. They settled it out of court. That did not go into court record. It was therefore not a public document. And it took an investigation by an investigative crew that I had of Ab Gross and Susan Burke. And I think both of them did a terrific job on it. It brought forth the true story on that, and it proved we were right that there was some shenanigans going on at that time. Well, of course, I'm real angry, and I got real sore at Dick Lyons, who was Commissioner of Economics and Development and all the other stuff like that. And Peter McDowell, I was pretty sore at him, too, because he was all mixed in it. Because Peter was the one that did the survey on the thing and recommended we deep six it. Then I come to find out that the Attorney General's office got into it when they figured, oh boy, here's a way to settle this thing out of court. We won't have to go to the Supreme Court. We had the case won. So they grabbed the opportunity and that eliminated that. But now in the meantime, I think that we've had ample time, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the Commissioner Lyons and Peter McDowell and those other people. But it was just a matter of us beating each other in the head with a 2x4 and understanding, hey, we're both right.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's work this thing out as a team now.
And what is the status of the Seward Grain Terminal now?
The status of the Seward Grain Terminal, I might point out to you, I hope you don't redline my little deal. I've started all over again with the status of the Seward Grain Terminal. I have just put in $800,000. Mike Miller out at North Pole and I worked together. We put $800,000 into a grain transfer facility that we granted to the city of North Pole. I'm hoping that Carletta Lewis and the assembly people in North Pole now will take this. They've got an opportunity to have something that'll make some money for them. But that is the first step of heading back south to the Seward Terminal down there. And we are also putting money into the coal facility, which is right adjacent to it. So, if you get knocked down one time, get up and keep going.
Okay.
What was that old song with from long ago, High Hopes, I believe it was, you
right.
know, and the ram and the million kilowatt dam? Never give up. Just keep going.
So, in the meantime, the terminal will sit there in whatever stage of completion it is, and we'll wait and see.
We'll wait and see, and we will probably do some other work. The thing is in a position where it could be finished up in very short order. But in the meantime, we got to transfer grain. It'll go to McKenzie Point, and you're buying chicken eggs right now that come out of Seward that's fed with Delta barley.
All right. You know, earlier in your speech, you talked about the difficulties of having a legislature with a lot of freshmen, with a lot of certain things they wanted to accomplish, and how things kind of degenerated. I think it's safe to say that a lot of Alaskans are becoming a little bit cynical about the way legislature as a whole and some individual members conduct themselves. Two big issues regarding the legislature itself this year were the pay raise and the legislative reform bill. How did you vote on the pay raise bill and why?
Well, the pay raise bill, I'm looking up at 294 up there, and I thought to myself, I can't go that thing, and I punched a red button. Fact of the business, there was 11 of us that punched the red button in the Senate side, and the bill failed. But Bob Ziegler and I, due to circumstances you might say that were beyond our control, found it necessary to change our vote after the bill failed. The bill then passed 11-9, but Ziegler and I changed our vote, and it passed.
And
this might be the same thing that we spoke about earlier. You have to compromise. And you look at it this way. The more I thought about the pay bill is this. The pay bill did not really increase the salary or the money that we get. It eliminated, of course, it eliminated the per diem during session. The one thing, though, and I didn't even think about it at the time, that has to do with the retirement benefits. Now, I honestly didn't think about it at that time. I was only thinking about the per diem business, and because it cost you a mint to live down there. It cost me around $1,500, $2,000 just to stay close enough to where I can work. That don't account what I got to pay out in fuel up here to keep my house warm up here. So I was losing money, really. And God knows I haven't got much of that to lose either. But the pay raise, and I'll say it this way, about the only people that can go down there and work and not worry themselves about how they're going to live are those people that are already pretty well off, and they are millionaires, or they've got a lot of things. A common citizen under the pay scale that we got cannot make it. consequently, the $46,000 that we roughly, maybe in a little bit over, $46,000 they raised it to came out of the house, the bill did. That included the average of the per diem for 120 days plus the salary that we were presently drawing. And that's basically what the figures were.
Okay.
And I might say one last thing. If you won't keep a bunch of monkeys down there, keep paying them peanuts.
All right. Well, we've run out of time, Pappy. We just get started with these things, and it always happens to us. I'd like to thank you very much for being with us today and taking the time to come over. I really enjoyed the interview, and I think our listeners will, too. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella.